Up next, the Baikai Podcast for August 8th, 2006, with Bill Scott of Yahoo and WordPress founder Matt Mullenweg. Welcome to Baikai, the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of ACM SigKai. I'm Steve Williams, and you're listening to the Baikai program for August 8th, 2006, Designing for Ajax with Bill Scott of Yahoo and WordPress founder Matt Mullenweg, who says the first 100K users are always the hardest. This program is in two parts. This is part two, Matt Mullenweg's presentation. Bill Scott's presentation is available separately. Matt describes strategies for scaling your community from 1 to 100,000 users and beyond. He has 12 rules, plus one more for free, including the importance of obsessing about details, doing your own support, blogging every step of the way, and being a painkiller, not a vitamin. If you write about this program on your blog, please consider using the tag Baikai. You'll find more Baikai programs, all produced by our generous volunteers, at baikai.org, where you can download audio and video or subscribe to our podcast feed. Links, slides, and notes for tonight's program are available at baikai.org/calendar/2006-0808. Now, here's Baikai's Rashmi Sinha to introduce Matt Mullenweg.
Our next speaker is Matt Mullenweg, and he is going to be talking about WordPress and some of his other software projects. Matt is the founding developer of WordPress, the blogging software that thousands of sites around the world. How many people here use WordPress? It's a bunch of you, yeah. It's a great piece of software. And he enjoys photography, writing, playing the saxophone and piano. He also founded Pingomatic and the nascent Global Media Protocols Group. And I don't quite know what that is. Maybe Matt will tell us. So I decided to invite Matt when I was at a recent conference and we were at dinner together, and he had this great story about how he came to write his anti-spam software. So I hope Matt is going to. It was all for his mother, and I hope he'll tell us that story. And I think, you know, even though Matt says that he's a developer and that's supposed to be, you know, what he masquerades as, I think he's really a user experience person at heart, because it's all about user needs and making publishing simpler. So with that, Matt.
Thank you very much. Well, as Bill was talking, I realized the common thread between us, which is we're both from Texas. And so if there's any vegetarians in the room, you might want to leave now. It's just going to get worse. As Rashmi said, my name is Matt Mullenweg. The road that started me down this path that has me here in front of you today was about 3 years ago. I founded a software project called WordPress, which is open source blogging software. And basically, from the beginning, the goal was just sort of making blogging easier, making publishing a little bit easier, because I was having a pretty hard time myself. So that developed a number of, you know, since I moved out to San Francisco, done a lot of things that the anti-spam technology at Kismet, which I guess I have to tell the story now since you said. Basically, what happened was I had finally, last August actually, my mom visited, and I didn't know she was going to stay this long, but she stayed for 5 weeks. Sort of put a little bit of a damper on my bachelor lifestyle. But so while she was there, I finally talked her into getting a blog, and I was really, really excited about that. But then I realized that on my blog every day, I was, you know, half the comments I was getting were for Viagra and, you know, Cialis and all this wonderful stuff, PPC, porn, pills, and casinos. I didn't want my mom to think this was what I was doing all day. That's Akismet is web anti-spam technology that was born of that solution. I had to fix the problem before my mom got there, and so far it's worked out pretty well thus far. Well, recently, I guess it's 9 or 10 months ago, I founded a company called Automatic, which the idea was, you know, we actually started to make a little money from all this WordPress stuff, and you know, as someone with an entrepreneurial spirit, I tend to be quite unemployable, so. Working for myself was the easiest thing to do. And since then, you know, we launched WordPress.com. We're at about 300,000 users now. WordPress.org has been growing really fast. We're getting, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 downloads every single day. And Akismet is blocking, you know, a couple million spams every day, like 1.8, 1 point something. So everything's been growing really fast. And lately, as more and more people are saying, you know, what did you do to get there? And so I've started to sort of think back and try to extract some patterns from the different projects I've been involved in, founded a couple now, and see if there's anything that's generically useful so that perhaps other people who are interested in starting something or passionate about something they want to, you know, devote a significant portion of their life to could share some of the many mistakes I've made along the way. So that's what this is, and it's called Getting to the First 100,000 Users is the Hardest, or something like that. I forget the title, but yeah. So just to dive right in, first thing you have to do, and I think this is an absolute prerequisite, is be your most passionate user. So what this means is that if you can't spend hours a day using your product, you can't expect anyone to. And you really have to think about and interact with what you're doing every day if you're going to have any perspective for moving it forward. Also, this is very important from a business point of view, because if you're the first employee, if you're the first volunteer, if you're the person leading the project, you have to be the most passionate person, because anyone you hire, anyone that comes on, is going to be less passionate than you. So you have to set the shining example and sort of lead by what you're doing, what you're feeling. Also, if it's not something you can get really passionate about, maybe it's not the best thing to, you know, devote your life to or devote a significant portion of your time. Next up. Originally, I called this be detail-oriented, but I figured this was a pretty hip crowd. So you have to be anal. And, you know, there's a million examples of this. But, you know, as you're going through, as you're using your product for hours and hours a day, you have to pay attention to every single little detail. The typography. Are all the quotes curled? Are you using M&N dashes properly? Ellipses? Are all the sentences punctuated correctly? Semicolons, all that good stuff. Are your emails being sent? What's the from address? If someone replies to it, what happens? Do you have fave icons for your website? So when they bookmark it, it works. Are your error pages just as informative and useful as your homepage? These are all things that, you know, when we're designing websites, we tend to gloss over them and move past. Because we, you know, I liken the danger of using something every day is it's sort of like touching a hot oven. And, you know, you touch it more and more and more and more. Eventually, it stops burning. And so the things that are really obvious to new users stop being obvious to you. So you have to keep yourself, you know, be young at heart. Be a new user every day. Next up, get off the computer. That includes those of you in the audience. Okay. What I've found is, especially when going through the design and thinking through things, anything that I do on the computer is a barrier. There's something in between me and the ideas that I'm trying to get to flow out. A great example of this is people who design using their CSS editor. And what they come out with tends to look very CSS-like. It reflects what they know and can do in CSS. Same thing with Photoshop. If you're using Photoshop to do all your mock-ups, your original mock-ups and your thinking, it is going to look like what you're good at in Photoshop. And for me, that means, you know, those really ugly gradients and stuff. So, you know, I find pencil and paper offline, someplace away from, you know, your daily distractions is really the best place. I recommend, you know, when you're thinking about your website, I'm the world's worst drawer, by the way, so don't let that, you don't think you have to be artistically inclined to do this, but, you know, sketch out what the website's going to look at. Like, you know, you draw the box on the page, start to fill it out a little. Try writing out your site's copy in longhand before typing it up. Anyone who's ever participated in a mailing list knows that people type faster than they think. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of people in the room. So the forcing yourself to slow down, I find, can be very, very valuable. So highly recommend that. You have to do your own support, especially in the beginning stages of launching something new or doing something. Your best feedback is going to come from, you know, those first couple hundred users. And too often than not, people launch things, put them out there, and then they don't interact with the follow-ups. They don't interact with the people having problems. Another advantage of doing your own support is that you intensely feel the pain of anything your users are feeling, you know? And, you know, if ideally, in the perfect model, that the people building applications would have a little electric shock hooked up to every single user. So when they got confused or felt stupid or you know, just didn't know what to do, you get a little jolt. And for me, that's email. You know, I get these emails, and they're like little jolts as they pile up into the thousands. But you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world, because that feedback is so valuable. The more things are between you and your users, the worse the product's going to be, quite honestly. And so, you know, try to eliminate those barriers at every step. For example, on WordPress.com, we had a feedback form that at the time I was very happy with. And it was on every page in the admin. You could click it. It'd slide down using some of those Ajax patterns. And you could send a message to the developers. And actually, it still, to this day, goes to every single person in the company, that message. But it seemed a little low, to be honest. The questions were a little bit too good, and we were getting too few. We were at, I think, 250,000 users at the time, and we were only getting 30, 40 a day. So what I did was I put a link at the bottom of all our public pages that said contact support, and I created a little support form. It's just a contact form. You don't have to do anything fancy there. And overnight, it doubled or tripled the number of requests we were getting to the support. And it also kind of halved the IQ. But that was good, because there was an entire swath of users that we weren't getting any feedback from. And it also identified, you know, the way we were choosing to get feedback self-selected, where people that were having activation problems or working the passwords, or all of Hotmail that decides to block all of our emails, we didn't know about that. And so it exposed a whole new range of problems that was really, really important to know. A corollary to this, there will be a point, if you're successful and you follow all these rules, that you won't be able to do the support anymore. And as soon as you see yourself starting to slack, as soon as you see yourself starting to get too behind, as soon as you're not providing the best possible, most personal experience for each person contacting you, seek help immediately. Get someone in who is extremely good with people to, you know, take some of that burden off. But I would still recommend reading it. The guy that helps us with our support is a guy named Pods from England. And he actually was a nurse for 18 years dealing with mentally disabled folks, which I think maps well. So, yeah, look for some retired nurses or whatever. But you need to get someone that's really passionate and has the patience, infinite patience, for that sort of thing. Every time someone contacts you is a complete opportunity to wow that person. And, you know, far too many companies waste those opportunities. Have a tagline. This is actually originally have a groovy tagline, but I didn't want to put it all out there. Basically what this means is that you should be able to distill whatever you're doing, whatever your idea is, whatever your vision is, into, you know, less than 5 words. And if you can't, maybe it's time to simplify what you're doing and scale it back a little. It's also good, just to go through this quickly, is to have some different taglines for different folks that you talk to. With WordPress, when I'm talking to librarians, you know, I like to frame it in terms of, this is like a Gutenberg press for the masses. I'm talking to politically active people, you know, activists. I say it's like the democratization of publishing. And, you know, these keywords resonate with different folks at different times. If I was talking to you guys, I'd say it doesn't suck that badly. But we could sure use some UI help if any of you have some volunteer time. But yeah, just distill what you're doing, and you know, have them ready, write them down, even if you don't show them to anyone, but have some taglines. Well, in these taglines, you want to talk about you, not me. And far too often, you can go to, you know, almost every corporate site in the world, and they love to tell you how great they are. Me, 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 me. We're so great. We do this. We're the Fortune 500, whatever. And not only is that a bad dating etiquette, it's bad business. You know, you should relate to the person you're talking to. Tell what you're going to do for them. You make it easy for you to upload and share your photos. Make it easy for, you know, frame it in terms of things that I actually care about. Because the honest truth is, no one except you cares about you. People care about themselves and what they're doing. You know, never bet against someone's self-interest. That's just the way the world works. Also, this also works really well for documentation, we found. The documentation that we've rewritten to sort of use this method and to, you know, talk about less about the program, less about WordPress, and more about the desired end goals, be it podcasting or whatever people want to do with their blogs. The readership has shot up, and also support has gone down. So it's always a good thing. Next up, 1.0. This is what you have to get at as soon as humanly possible. And you've heard it a million times before. You're going to hear it a million more because it's true. Nothing beats real users using your product. You will never imagine the things they will think of and the feedback they will have and the places they will take you. So it's really important to get that first version out as soon as possible, even if it sucks. It always will suck. So just, you know, come to grips with that fact and move on and release early and often. This is something, you know, personally we've had trouble with in the open source project, but, you know, we're really trying to crank a few more out because the iterative process has been far, far, far more useful to us and our users than just, you know, going away in our ivory tower for 6 months making functional specs and deciding what the future of publishing is going to be. We've had a lot better luck with just listening to what people are telling us and getting out there as soon as possible. Related to that, have metrics for everything you do. Basically, what this means is that if you're not measuring the things that your users are doing and the metrics of your success, you're never going to know when you get there. Whatever your product or service is, try and decide what is it that people, that there will be more of or less of, that that means you're successful. We have, actually, I wish I could show the page, but we have a page with a ton of metrics that we track for WordPress.com, and it's everything from the number of support requests per day, number of posts per day, number of comments, you know, page views, all these things. And again, just like the early point, make this about them, not you. Every business in the world will track their financials, how much money they got, all the stuff that none of your users actually care about. But what we're trying to do is move it to the things that define what successful blogging is. And I don't know if we know what that is yet, but the best guesses mean that people love getting page views. They love getting comments. And they love, well, hopefully, if they're happy with what they're doing, they'll post more. So if we can track number of posts per users per day, that's far more valuable than just knowing the number of posts. Furthermore, if we know how many comments those posts are getting, you know, that's a pretty valuable thing because that means that their audience is interacting with people saying everyone, we had some bloggers in the audience, right? You love the comments. And instead of just the raw page views, what about the page views for the bottom 50%? I mean, I know every day Scovel's going to get a ton of hits. Does that really matter? No. It matters with that new blogger who just started their blog. Are we making it, are we having a way for them to be discovered, for them to find other folks that care about the same things that they care about? And these are tough questions, and it's going to be different for every product, service, and business out there. But if you don't think about them, you'll never know if you're getting better or worse. Another cool thing is that we can correlate changes. We also have, you know, everything we do is in a subversion repository. So we can sort of sometimes look, like, oh, crap, Tuesday, the support request tripled. What did we do that day? And you never remember. But we can look at the change sets and say, okay, that's the day when, you know, we changed the wording on button X, or we added this JavaScript thing that take two times to load the page. You know, if you have all that data available, even if you don't use it, it might be useful in ways that you can't anticipate. This is another problem. I see a ton of startups, ton of new products have this. They don't know. They're like a dog chasing a car. They actually catch it. They don't know what the hell they're going to do. So if you have these metrics, if you know, you know, if users do more of X, we're considering ourselves a success. If they do a ton of X, how do you scale? How does that affect your business? How does what do you do when you sort of win? Often, not anticipating success is one of the biggest problems. It's a good problem to have compared to some others. But, you know, you're at this presentation, so I'm sure you're all going to do really well. Users are pretty tricky. You should do as they do, not as they say. And basically, something, and this is really, really obvious in many, many open source projects. I'm sure you've all dealt, actually, as a good example, I'm using OpenOffice right now as opposed to PowerPoint or Keynote, which is my favorite. And you see all this junk at the top and bottom? For the life of me, I can't figure out how to make it go away and to go into second monitor. I would love for that not to be there. It sort of ruins the all black effect and everything. But open source projects tend to accumulate features and weird options. I wish I could show you the option panel for this, because I went through it and it must have had like literally tree levels going three deep, 500 plus options that I looked through prior to this session, and not a single one that I could find. But I imagine the result of that, and how I've seen when we've done this badly in WordPress, is someone says, I want to do X. To do X, it would be great if I had option Y. Or they say, you know, I want to, you know, link to people in my blog role. So every time I open the link dialog, there should be a list of everyone in my blog role, and I should just be able to click it or something. And the problem is that people are talking to you within their current frame of reference. They're telling you what they think the solution to the problem is, rather than what maybe the actual solution to the problem is. Great example of this is that at the time, around WordPress 1.2 days, we have a ton of people asking for a feature, multiple blogs, essentially. They said, I want to have, you know, unlimited blogs. I want to have as many as I can. And I started to look at what people were actually doing, because I didn't know that each person that was asking this had like five blogs. I go to their site, I'd only see the one. So it turns out what was happening is they were using the multiple blog feature of other software to manage things like an about page and, you know, different other non-blog parts of their content. So it became really obvious that even though they were asking for multiple blogs, because that was their current frame of reference, what they really needed was a way to manage simple amounts of non-chronological content. So we added the pages feature, which is just the most brain-dead content management you could ever do. And it was wildly successful. Because now all of a sudden someone could have an about page within their blog template and edit it, and you know they didn't have to worry about anything else. So you know, watch what your users are doing and don't always listen to them too closely. Simplify. I could talk about this for hours, but that would sort of defeat the purpose. Start strong and end strong. You only get one chance to make a first impression. The most important thing, well, again, this is a good example of companies and businesses focusing on the wrong thing. They will spend hours and hours. I'm sure some people in here, has anyone in here participated in a homepage redesign? Raise your hands. Duck and cover. Man, everyone gets their fingers in that, don't they? But the funny thing is, it's 2006 now. You know, search engines have more use than anything. The average query length is 2.8 words. People aren't coming to your homepage anymore. They're coming to that random page on your site that happens to contain the keywords they were looking for. Maybe you don't have what they were looking for. Maybe you do. If you do, how are you addressing those people? Are you giving them the exact same UI? Is that page on your site, three or four levels deep, just as informative and inviting as your homepage? If it's not, why? You got to start strong with every single person that's newly experiencing whatever you have to offer, be it your website, be it your service, be it your application. Another good example of this is, especially with blogs, they have far, far more readers than writers. You know, we have far more page views per day coming to random blogs than we do people who are actually writing them. So what can you do to capture some of that? What can you do to say, hey, if you want to do this too, here's a link. Get a blog. Get a free blog. It's easy. You know, that sort of thing. It's another case of huge lost opportunities. You know, many sites, a lot of the sites I run, you know, 50, 60% of the traffic is coming from Google every day. What does that mean? Who are these people? I don't know, but you should know. And you should try to talk to them in a special way because they are different than your normal visitors. And they're not you. They're not going to your homepage and saying, oh, this is so pretty. Look at that smiling, you know, young, single, white female in the headset looking up, waiting for my call. It's not how the world works. And this is not my last point, because you have to end strong, too. So the number one thing, if you remember nothing else from this presentation, is to be a painkiller, not a vitamin. If you're thinking about starting a service or creating something new, if you want people to spend time with it, you have to keep in mind that everyone has a life. They have kids, they have family, they have, you know, the dog at home that's probably peeing somewhere. They have a million other things that are going on. And your new website, your new service is probably the last thing on their mind. They don't care about your Ajax to-do list. They don't care about, you know, your personal publishing blogging platform. They have things they want to do. They want to connect with their friends. They want to, you know, spend less time in front of the computer every day. They probably don't want to read a million RSS feeds. They just want to read what's interesting to them. And at the end of the day, there's far too many services I see being launched, which are just vitamins. The things that very abstractly, if you did it every day and you used them exactly like you were prescribed, you might get a little better. You know, it might be something that helps you out. Anyone want to guess what sells more, Centrum or Tylenol? No, seriously, the entire market for vitamins is several hundred million dollars. Tylenol alone, not counting hospital sales and Walmart sales, is $800 million a year. And you know people going to Walmart are going to need a lot of Tylenol, so that's just something to keep in mind. Again, it ties back to a couple of the previous points. You know, you have to be thinking about the person interacting with your site and putting them first. You have to be thinking, how am I saving them time? How am I making them happier? How am I helping them kick ass? Because if you're not, you know, you don't matter. And that's all I got. Any questions? And please say your name and where you're from.
So my name is Michael Robertson. I'm from a startup called Krillion.com.
What was the startup name?
Krillion.
Krillion.
As in million.
As in million. All right.
So how do you reconcile the just get 1.0 out there with start strong and strong?
Oh, man, someone was listening. I wasn't counting on that. Well, there's a little bit of both. I mean, how do you reconcile getting something out there as soon as possible with being anal and being detail-oriented? Because, you know, if you're paying attention to every single little thing and waiting, you know, you want to start strong before you get something out there, you would never launch. And really, it's just a matter of the various strengths and weaknesses. There's pros and cons. But the truth is that there's not a successful company you can look at that is doing today what they thought they were going to do. You know, Apple was doing circuit boards. Microsoft was doing programming languages and stuff like that. You know, where you start is not going to be where you end up. So you have to fail as soon as possible. That's because you are. I mean, no matter what you think, whatever you do first is going to fail horribly in ways you never expected. And your success is going to be based on how fast you can adapt, how agile you are, and how much attention you're paying to the people who are, you know, giving you their time of day, who are kind enough and early adopters enough to use you and, you know, care about you when you do suck. So, does that answer the question? Sort of? Yeah, okay.
My name is Joe. I'm doing a peer-to-peer reputation currency. My question is, how do you bootstrap something that, on the order of thousands of first-time users, to be useful? And if you have only hundreds, it's not very practical.
So how do you bootstrap something that needs a lot of people?
Yeah, think of a currency, think of money. If you just have your friends, you don't need money, right? It's only if you have strangers.
Sure. So, you know, that first PayPal user, who do they send money to? That's a good question. I guess I would say, well, of course, getting out there early always helps. But furthermore, you have to reconsider your value proposition. So if you're not providing some sort of immediate value, people aren't going to stick around. You can't say, you see this problem all the time with social networks. They're useless, but invite 100 of or 2,000 of your closest friends, and all of a sudden you can look at their pictures or something like that. What real value is being provided there? It gets trickier. It sounds like you're doing something, currency-based or something like that. So that's really tough. So, well, something that made, this is sort of related, kind of not sort of, but I'll say it anyway. One of the reasons that WordPress did really well or started taking off when it started growing is we had made the switching cost as low as we possibly could from a competitor that had, you know, 90%+ of the market. And basically, it was theirs to lose. And they had a little goof up, and we were sort of their rating. We had just released version 1.1 like a week later and had a flawless importer. So we made the pain of moving to this thing as low as possible. And if you can keep the pain, I'm sure there's competitors to what you're doing today. So if you can provide some sort of importer, some sort of switching mechanism, something to eventually, well, especially, I don't know who your competitors are in the market. If you're competing against a startup, you're probably in trouble. If you're competing against a big company, you might do okay. If you're competing against a public company, you're set. I mean, you'll be fine. Because they're paralyzed by how big they are, how public they are, how slow they're moving. So, I mean, just, you know, wait for that moment. Be ready for when they screw up, because they inevitably will. So, sort of a general advice. Rajmi, in front.
So how would you compare the experiences in launching WordPress.com as opposed to the WordPress.org, the software, and the experiences, the difference in the experiences there in growing both?
So what was the first part?
So I'm asking you to compare the experience with WordPress.com and you know, the WordPress, the installable software that people...
So with WordPress.org, well, on one hand, we were incredibly lucky in that we were in a platform, PHP, MySQL, that was also taking off. And you could run it on any of these, you know, $5 hosts, which, of which there are tens of thousands around the world. How people generally interact with it is they come find a blog that uses WordPress, they click through the WordPress.org, and if they're tech savvy, they would download the software and know all the inane junk that you need to get it running. You know, your database details, how to upload things, or sometimes it might be bundled with their host. So if you're on Yahoo, Small Business, or Bluehost, or Dreamhost, or one of those, it's sort of a one-click install. But those tend to be pretty tech-savvy people. One thing that helped was from the very beginning, it was a little bit marketing, a little bit truth. We had what was called a five-minute install, where at the time, web scripts were very, very difficult to get going. You have to edit 10 config files, and then you'd have to go back and edit the config file again, you know, if you wanted to change the title of your blog, for example. So we tried to eliminate all that. But again, it was sort of limiting the audience. I felt like we were creating something kind of cool with WordPress, and you know, I did want it to just be limited to the tech-savvy folks. So we were trying to take, with WordPress.com, take it from the five-minute install to the five-second install, which is easy as getting a Hotmail account or, you know, a LiveJournal or something like that to get going. And what has happened as a result is it's helped the software grow a lot, not just because of technical reasons, where, you know, we know a lot more about scaling and the performance of the software now, but also just because there's a set of people who were previously, you know, completely barred, you know, from using the software that are now interacting with it on a day-to-day basis and, you know, building businesses on it and investing, you know, hours and hours at a time. And so we have a set of passionate users with, you know, we can't assume the same skill sets that we previously once did. You know, there's a ton of jargon in blogging, permalinks, trackbacks, pingbacks, all this stuff that's actually kind of confusing. And so we're having to do a lot of simplification. You know, we're having to cut back on a lot of things. And a lot more of the, you know, watching what people do rather than what they say. Because it's just an entirely different level. You know, we got a support email the other day where someone says, is my blog going to be online if I turn off my computer? Oh, you know, I hope so. But, you know, I hope that if we can make the software work amazingly for that set of users, yet still stay true to the .org folks who are, tend to be technically savvy, who tend to be people who download and install stuff, we'll create something that's pretty powerful and, you know, can, you know, affect a lot of people. So it's tough, especially balancing those two, because sometimes they want very different things, like our WYSIWYG editor. Half the .org population hated the WYSIWYG, like with a passion. But, you know, it was something that was so obvious that we had to do. You know, we couldn't expect people to type in HTML every time they wanted to link or to insert a picture. So there's a middle ground there, and, you know, sometimes we find it, sometimes we don't, but we're trying. I saw a hand right around there.
Up here.
Oh, up, okay.
Hello. My name is Deanne.
Hi, Danny.
Name?
Deanne.
Dan.
Deanne. It's one of those funny names. I think you kind of answered a bit of the question with that last remark of, will my website still be up when I turn off my computer? But do you see any value in, because you're an open source project, having user feedback posted in blog fashion and available to the public? Or if it's closed, if it's an email form as you've said it is, what filters do you have in place to make it relevant and bearable for your developers?
So there's two things there. On one hand, you know, and it can be painful sometimes, we're giving all of our users speakerphones. And sometimes they use them quite loudly, and they're, you know, telling the world their problems or their concerns and their hates about the software. On the plus side, sometimes they tell them, you know, what they love about it. As to versus feedback from people blogging versus feedback people might send in, again, it's just a matter of making it as low barriers as possible. There's a type of person who will, you know, blog their concerns or who will send a message to a mailing list, which is probably not representative of most users. So they're very, very important. You have to listen to them and respond to them. You know, watch whatever your product name is. Watch it on Technorati. Watch it on Feedster. See what people are saying about you, because silly not to. But I feel like the feedback that comes in from those very low threshold methods, the contact form and the feedback form, is a little bit more representative and a little bit more indicative of the users we're trying to reach rather than the users we currently reach. I think we're doing an all right job. You know, we're not bad for that .org core contingent. But in terms of the people who are coming to .com, we still kind of suck. I mean, there's a million things that we're just too hard. We assume too much knowledge. We use weird jargon everywhere. So, you know, that feedback form is really valuable. And how do we bubble it up? Probably not as well as we could. You know, I'd love to publish every single thing that comes in. But we can't, because people send in passwords. And, you know, one time someone set us the password to their computer so we could fix their blog. It just, you know, weird stuff like that. And but we could probably do a better job of maybe like a daily summary of that. Or and maybe having some of that filter up into a block. And, you know, that hadn't occurred to me until you suggested it. So maybe that's something we'll do going forward.
Thanks. My name is Jeff.
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 Cool.
I was wondering if you could talk a little about going from running an open source project and turning that into presumably a business that allows you to leave your day job.
What was like the last part?
Leaving your day job. Like the progression from maybe an open source part-time thing and how that evolved into a business that you're presumably making money from.
Well, part of it was a ton of luck. I was in college. I actually dropped out to work for CNET, who was basically, it was a Linus Torvalds model. They were using WordPress a ton, and they were going to pay me to work a good chunk of my time on WordPress. So that enabled me to focus a lot more on the software. And, you know, which I was doing anyway, but more to the degradation of my grades and such. So at least now it was what people wanted me to do. But actually the business came around in a very roundabout way. We had started to develop a lot of relationships with different hosting partners, and it started bringing a non-trivial amount of money. And I said, well, crap, you know, what do we do now? It's gonna screw up my taxes. So around the same time, Donica, who was the first employee, I was actually a third employee technically, was leaving his job in Ireland. And there was enough coming in and enough going out that we could cover his salary. And he was sort of the first employee. And so, and you know, we were completely into black until about 2 months ago. And we went into the red, and we're going to dip back into the black in a month or two. But it's been tough. I don't know if every open source project could do it. We're lucky in that we have a consumer-facing project like Firefox, where, you know, regular users are users, and a lot of open source projects tend to be more back-end things like PHP or Apache, and they're forced to go the very enterprise-y route, where the people who are going to pay them are big businesses. I think ultimately to the, you know, that sort of route ultimately leads to the detriment of the product, because those types of customers often have very specific needs, niche needs, and they tend to drive complexity rather than simplification, which is, I think, the ultimate goal of where a lot of software should go and very few software does. So we're just lucky, really, that we're in. The timing of WordPress was good. That's another thing. I forgot to say this, but don't listen to anyone if they say, that market is full. Because when WordPress launched, the market was saturated, everyone said. And now, 2 or 3 years later, blogging is way, 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 way bigger. And, just by sticking with it, we managed to capture some of that ride. And we're also in a model where there's some pretty proven business models. I don't think you should try. A lot of businesses try to innovate everything at once. They're going to innovate their software and their platform and their web server and their business models and their Rome fighting four wars in four different directions at once. We're trying to innovate the business a little bit, in that all the code is going back into open source. Again, there are some examples for that, but I've tried to align the structure of the business in that it just, even if I wasn't there, it economically makes sense for all the code to be released as GPL. And I forgot what I was going to say after that. So there you go.
So my name's Paul, and I'm from Kansas.
Kansas?
Yeah.
Is that a company?
I had a question about the ratio of readers to writers, because it's an interesting issue of like how long people have lurked and what does it take to activate them. It seemed to me that when it was HTML rather than blogging, the ratio of readers to writers was much higher.
Astronomical.
And I was just curious if you have some sense of the actual measures of how long people are readers before they become writers, if you know what the ratio is within the WordPress population, because it seems like a really interesting issue.
Roughly, I could say that this week we're doing about 1.7 million page views a day and probably only getting around 50 or 60,000 bloggers publishing every day. So that's a pretty wide gap. If I had a guess, I would say, probably someone more mainstream than us would be a better barometer. So, Bill said that, 5 to 10% of any given property will contribute it back and be writers and active contributors.
I just saw something recently, and I don't remember where, that said maybe 1% was closer to it in terms of content creation in general rather than blogging in particular. But, you'll hear everything from 1 to 20, right? So,
Well, hopefully. So that's the numbers that I know of right now. If we're doing our job right, that gap will get smaller and smaller. I think the future of blogging isn't the Scobles and the Tech Crunches and the Wall Street Journals. It's really a person communicating with a couple other people who they care about. And to the extent we can enable that and remove the barriers that are keeping people from blogging right now, hopefully that number, will it ever break 50%? I don't know. I would love to see that, maybe in my lifetime. But it's a tough, tough journey. The concepts of the web are changing, and they're on our side. I'm sure all of us can remember when people were scared of putting their credit card online, because they didn't know where it was going or who could see it. And now that's sort of just a given. We do it every day. No one even thinks about it. I'm hoping that 5 to 10 years from now, publishing on the web won't be such a foreign concept to folks. And my generation, my peers, are currently putting things on the web I think are ridiculous, and they shouldn't be. But, maybe when they grow up a little and mature and figure out about the Internet Archive, they'll want tools that give them a little more fine-grained control over what they're putting out there. They'll still have the passion for putting things out there, but just want a little more fine-grained control over it. A big time when we see that shift happening now is when folks have kids, because all of a sudden they have another life, another person, that they often don't want to make presumptions about how much they want to be online or in the public eye. So all of a sudden they become very, very conscious about, is their name on the internet? Are there pictures on the internet? Can anyone see it? And it's actually happening just within our company. We started out all bachelors. Now everyone's getting hitched and knocking up folks. So not me. But yeah. As our company grows, my mom's listening to this. No, mom. As our company is growing, that's something we're figuring out as well. As we're the first users and the ones we pay attention to the most, for better and worse. So that's needs that we're starting to develop. It's also good because the more you can, the closer the connection is from the person doing the writing to the person reading it, I think the more likely that the reader will become a writer. There's a saying that people never believe what you tell them. They sometimes believe what you show them. They usually believe what their friends tell them, but they always believe what they tell themselves. So we need to get their friends telling them that blogging is the cat's pajamas, and then, you know, eventually them telling themselves that publishing online is okay and cool and fun and safe. Yeah. But it's a long-term thing. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. The background music is River from the album Arras by Curandero. The music of Curandero is available from magnatune.com. This program was produced entirely by Baikai volunteers, thanks to program chairs Paul Sass and Rashmi Sinha. I recorded the program. We're extremely grateful to Park for providing the meeting space and the services of our terrific sound engineer, Deanna Horvath. Thank you to all the other Baikai volunteers who serve the Kai community and, of course, especially to Baikai members for your support. Thank you.